healthier, safer, and happier community.
To In the Motherhood on CKUT 90.3 FM here in Montreal. It's Wednesday, January 18th, 2023, and I'm your host for this month's show, Robin Fadden. On today's show, we're featuring two different radio documentaries borrowed from Wings, which is another feminist-focused community radio show, and thank you to Wings for sharing your great content with us. This first interview investigates the concept of virgin birth, which most of us might associate with Christmas and the birth of Jesus, which, you know, just happened a month ago. Well, not his birth, but Christmas. But it's actually something that appears throughout history from the time of ancient Greece. So this is an interesting interview to look into why that is a thing. The second piece of radio content I'll play after this one is about period pride and menstruation celebration and accommodation in India and around the world. I'll play that first interview now. Thanks for listening to CKUT and In the Motherhood.
Today from the Wings Archives. We've heard the term virgin birth in connection with Christianity, but it sounds to me as if you're saying that Christians didn't originate this idea.
Right.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Frieda Worden. It's almost Christmas of 2007 as my guest and I commence to talk by phone. Her name is Marguerite Rigoyoso. Hi, Marguerite.
Hi, Frieda.
Marguerite has a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in philosophy and religion, with a focus on women's spirituality. She recently completed her doctoral dissertation at the California Institute of Integral Studies. Its title is Bearing the Holy Ones, a Study of the Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece. And by divine birth, Marguerite, I gather you refer specifically to virgin birth.
Yes. In the world in which Mary and Jesus emerged, there was a lot of belief in miraculous or unusual births. There were many claims that ancestral figures, as well as historical figures and political leaders from Egypt all the way through Greece and probably into West Asia as well, were born through various miraculous means.
So what kind of timeline are we talking about where we know that these virgin births or miraculous births took place?
Well, in Egypt, the beginning of the pharaonic period is approximately 3000 BC, more or less. And my understanding is that from the very beginning, it was claimed that the pharaohs were born miraculously from queens who had sex with gods that resulted in a conception. Now, in Egypt, part of the ritual involved the previous pharaoh, the living pharaoh, the man, who would have sex with the woman, but it was understood that he was sort of getting out of the way and the god was coming into his body, and that the conception that would occur was a result of the god and not the man interacting with the woman's body, and that then the next pharaoh would be born who was considered divine also himself, and that this is how the lineage of these divine kings continued. So we've got that. That's, you know, back to 3000 BCE. My work looks more at ancient Greece, but I'm looking more into the legendary period, which would be pre-1500 BCE, more or less.
Okay. We'll get to that period in a minute, but I wanted to ask you about the definition of virgin birth. It sounds like what you're talking about of miraculous birth in Egypt isn't the same as virgin birth. And today, I mean, when we talk about virgin birth, everybody starts thinking about hymen. And for us, in the last few centuries, virginity has been defined as having an intact hymen. So it seems like if you're going to have a virgin birth, there would be two problems to overcome. First, how to get inseminated without breaking the hymen, and then how to give birth without breaking it, which always seemed rather shocking to me. I guess unless you had cesarean. But is that the approach that the ancients took to virginity and virgin birth in the period that you were discussing?
Right. Well, it's a little bit complicated because when I started looking at all of these stories and histories, I determined that there were several methods of divine conception. Do you want me to sort of outline them? There are like three major ways.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Well, the one for which we have the most documented evidence is the one that I discussed about ancient Egypt. And you have some instances of this in Greece, where it seems that what was happening was a sacred marriage union, in Greek known as hieros gamos, between the queen and the king. But, again, it was understood that the king was only a stand-in for the god, and that the conception was not really happening through him, but it was happening through the god. So that, I say, is a later stage of this whole miraculous or divine birth practice. Prior to this, what I discern in the stories, and this is, again, now looking particularly at the Greek material, is this whole series of events where women seem to be described as having sex with gods without human males present, and it resulting in conception and birth, and that many of the major legendary figures and some of the living historical figures had legends of miraculous birth around them in this way. These were female figures who did not have sex with men, but with gods exclusively. So that might be suggesting a different method. And then I extrapolate back further, because those stories you see in the patriarchal period where the gods are taking precedence over the goddesses, and all the female figures are being rendered either wives or daughters of the god now, rather than authoritative virgin mothers themselves. So I extrapolate back, because I am a follower of the belief that there was an earlier period of matriarchy on the planet, and that prior to this sex with God method, there was a method of pure parthenogenesis in which women could train in this yoga, if you will, of learning how to give birth miraculously without having sex with men or with gods. It just coming out of them through these spiritual means that made them, the women, one with the creative goddess herself. So it put them on the par of divinity. So I see these three types of practices that we can go back to. That last one is my most conjectural.
I don't know if you are familiar with the work of Doris Lessing, who recently won the Nobel Prize for Literature. One of her most recent books is called The Cleft, and in it she is going back through the voice of a Roman historian to look at a prehistoric time that was only recorded in oral history, according to her, in which females gave birth to females parthenogenetically and then suddenly started to give birth to males. And so there was a period of disturbance because they thought they'd given birth to monsters and so forth. And then eventually parthenogenetic births started to wane and births through conception increased. And she tells that story without any spiritual side of how the conception might have taken place. But you're saying possibly there was a method of parthenogenesis that was induced by practices.
Yes, and I do posit two different stages of the matriarchal, just as you have described Doris Lessing describing in presumably a fictional format, that first it was daughter-bearing, because naturally a woman will theoretically always give birth to a female if it's parthenogenetically conceived, because her egg only has female chromosomes. So I posit that there was a second phase of that pure parthenogenesis where somehow they managed to either figure out, Doris is saying that it was an anomaly, but I'm saying that it was deliberate, a method of figuring out how to produce males with the Y chromosome through this same pure parthenogenetic means. There was a lot of sort of grassroots literature in the late 70s and early 80s from the lesbian feminist community which got very interested in this topic of parthenogenetic conception purely on the scientific level, on the biological level, really not talking about it as a spiritual practice, which is the way I'm talking about it. So there are a lot of speculations about what women's capacities might be purely on a biological level, but I just wish to distinguish that I'm talking about religiously induced parthenogenesis, and this is getting back to your idea of there having been a specific practice that women did in order to accomplish this.
So you think that this could actually happen. What leads you to believe that? Is it the historical record?
Right. It's interesting because in my dissertation, I actually don't try to make the argument that it was real and that it happened. I say that I believe that the Greeks thought it was real and that it happened. But if you ask me personally, I think the door does need to be open to this possibility.
Well, the Greeks weren't so dumb when it came to documenting natural events.
Right. And so your question was,
what makes you think that it might have really happened?
Right. Okay. The whole idea, first of all, came to me while I was working on my master's thesis about Demeter and Persephone, the mother-daughter goddesses. And I had a flash of intuition during that time that that mother-daughter conception right there was reflecting a pure parthenogenetic daughter-bearing mystery. And once that flash came to me, I began thinking, it just came to me, the idea that, oh my goodness, I think that women were actually trying this. And once that idea had gotten implanted in my mind, and then I went looking at the historical records of cult in ancient Greece, as well as the legendary and mythological stories, not discounting them as pure fiction, but considering that they might have more than kernels of historical truth in them. Once I started approaching those with that possibility, things started falling into remarkable patterns, and patterns that I didn't even expect. And I was able to construct what I believe were these various types of parthenogenetic priestesses, and just found that there was an enormous amount of material, an enormous number of myths attesting to such occurrences, as well as in the historical period, figures such as Alexander the Great, Pythagoras, Plato. They had miraculous birth stories surrounding them.
Oh my gosh, even as recently as Plato and Pythagoras, there were miraculous birth stories.
Yes, as recently as some of the Roman leaders, which I don't get to in my dissertation, so I'm not an expert on those. But so, you know, and this, of course, would have all been simultaneously with what was going on down in Egypt with these claims since 3000 BCE happening. So I was putting together all of these claims, be they from the historical record or the mythological record, and this amazing story started unfolding.
Hmm.
I thought, wow, this has been right in front of our eyes all the time, and nobody's just laid these things side by side and begun to see the patterns.
Well, I want to talk to you some more about the patterns, but first, let me play devil's advocate for a minute and say, wasn't it enough simply that it was of great advantage to leaders and their followers to set themselves off from ordinary mortals? I mean, was this claim of virgin birth or miraculous birth really politically and socially useful, and to whom? I mean, what about that it served the patriarchy?
Right. And that argument would be the typical Western rationalist view looking on this, that these are no more than fictional claims used to legitimize authority, right? But I'm flipping that argument around, and I'm saying, but gee, those claims didn't just come out of nowhere, perhaps. Let's trace them back, and let's sort of look at the volume of material and see what might really have been going on here. And when you do that, it starts to take the shape of something that was not necessarily fictional, but something that was very ancient, very anciently practiced. And again, yes, when it starts coming onto the record, we see it mostly as patriarchy using it to, you know, foster claims of divine birth and legitimizing kings' reigns and so forth and so on. But, you know, I think it depends on what viewpoint you're open to looking at it with. Do you want to just take the pure skeptical view, or do you want to open to some other possibilities here? Because when you do start opening to some other possibilities, as I said, the story just balloons out into something that has been right in front of our eyes the whole time.
Well, there certainly are a lot of other discoveries that have been made that were deemed impossible. So I certainly am not prepared to say that that you're wrong about this.
Since this interview was recorded, Marguerite Rigoyoso has published 3 books: The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece, Virgin Mother Goddesses of Antiquity, and The Mystery Tradition of Miraculous Conception, Mary and the Lineage of Virgin Births.
I would like to ask you some questions about, in particular, this cult of divine birth that you discuss in your work. And I gather that by cult you mean, at least in part, a group of actual women priestesses who collectively pursued some methodology for giving birth to heroes. And you also make a very bold statement that these women were foundational in the culture of Greece. So please, would you tell us how you know about these women?
Right. I started looking at the legends and the stories, these Greek stories about women having sex with gods, being raped by gods, and so forth. And I started discerning in that these were not just random stories, but that this must have been reflecting an underlying cult. Because so many of these women, when you look at their genealogy and so forth, they are somehow connected with a goddess in one way or another, which seems to indicate that they may have been priestesses of particular goddesses. Goddesses particularly like Hera, Athena, and Artemis. These are 3, and Gaia. These are 4 of the major goddesses around which you have these female characters that get involved in these impregnation stories with gods, often against their will. So lead me back to the thread of your question.
Oh, okay. So, I was wondering how you got onto this idea of a particular impregnation cult of this type, and what are the pieces that you've put together to get this picture?
Right. You know, it was just piecing together all these stories and all of these legends around certain sacred sites like Delphi and Dodona. All of a sudden, when you start looking at the stories of the figures whose names are the ones that are used for these sites, for the mountains, for the caves, and so forth, the names are all either these women who gave birth miraculously or their children. So, you know, I looked at it and I said, something else deeper is going on here. And what I discerned is that there were these priestesses of these specific goddesses, Hera, Gaia, Artemis, and Athena, who in their earliest stages were dedicated to pure divine birth on behalf of these goddesses, because the story seemed to suggest that this was always a sacred activity. This wasn't just something people did every day as an alternate method of reproduction. It had a specific purpose, and the purpose was to bring in a high holy being. I discern in these stories the idea that for some reason it was not possible for humans of a certain divine nature to come in through regular sexual intercourse between a regular man and a woman. That there was something in this specialized, miraculous activity that was done with intention by women who were essentially yoginis or shamans, working at the highest levels of their craft, because this would have been the highest level of initiation open to any spiritual person on the planet, that through their intention and through their working with these other, you know, astral realms and their deities and so forth, they were bringing in special higher level beings that were thought to benefit the planet in some way. And so we have stories in the Christian tradition, this is Jesus. In the Greek tradition, we have Dionysus, Asclepius, and then we have legendary figures who were these heroes of Greek civilization. And almost, you know, when you look at the genealogies of these heroes, these ancient ancestral leaders who were the beginning points of royal lineages and so forth, almost down to a one, they have a divine birth story attached to them. So it seems to be that miraculous birth was some kind of mechanism for communicating with deities and bringing special, almost superhuman-type beings onto the planet, if you will. And under the best-case scenario, that was to advance the evolution of the planet. And under the worst-case scenario, it was to advance agendas that we might think of as not completely savory, such as the patriarchal agenda that had to do with a lot of warfare. And so you get Greek, quote, mythological heroes such as Heracles, Perseus, Theseus, and others who all have miraculous birth stories, and then have these heinous stories of what they went about doing on the planet as ancestral figures of Greek civilization.
Now, do you have some kind of a sense of what they might actually have been doing? I mean, what was involved in this type of yoga or right. spiritual activity?
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's important to say that the way I'm conceiving this is it was a specialized spiritual activity that would have involved intensive training, just the way any yogi in India has to be trained. And by the way, these miraculous abilities have been attributed to yogis and shamans all over the planet, things like walking through walls, walking on water, changing your hair from gray to black, changing your metabolism, walking very rapidly through, you know, miles of space in very quick succession. So these attributes called siddhis have been supposedly attested to, you know, for holy people in various traditions, Buddhist and Hindu and so forth. So my supposition is, wouldn't the ultimate siddhic ability have been miraculous birth? And the answer is yes, and that thus for women, it was the only way open. And so how would they have done this? Well, you know, I don't get into a lot of that in the dissertation, but you get little hints of it in the mythologies. And one common motif you get is the flash of light. The flash of light that somehow hits the woman, presumably in the uterine area. The story of Io, Hera's priestess, who miraculously conceived the legendary Egyptian king Apophis through a union with Zeus. There is a legend connecting her with a flash or a ray of light coming from the heavens into her. We get this motif repeated in the stories and the paintings of Mary. Mary's conception is sometimes conceived of as a ray of light. So this leads you to say, so if they were working in trance, presumably, you know, this is not like somebody's just going to sit down and miraculously conceive. This would be a focused activity, I would presume, under trance. They must have been working with certain principles of light and energy and photons and electrons, and, you know, down to the building blocks of matter itself, I would think, not to mention DNA. And it's interesting because in the laboratory, chemical means for inducing parthenogenetic, in other words, virgin conception of eggs in both animals and humans, has involved heat, shock, and chemicals to get it started. So this makes me think, you know, were these women working somehow with the heat in their body, conceived of as light or what have you? I also think that another method to induce their trance may have involved sacred medicines, what we would call hallucinogens or entheogens. And I do find evidence that they were using things like marijuana, the priestesses of Hera, that was a plant that was sacred to her, the Delphic Oracle, where I find lots of stories of miraculous births in the toponyms and place names there. The Delphic Oracle, there are many descriptions of what seemed to be her getting very much drugged up before she was going on that tripod and prophesying. And one of the drugs that seemed to come up was this hallucinogenic vapor that at the time was coming through the earth itself, but she was also chewing laurel leaves, she was breathing in fumes from a fire that might have had hemp seeds, and so forth.
Huh. I did want to ask you about one other thing that's related to this, because I heard you on another radio programming discussing someone who could restore women to a state of virginity, and you said that it wasn't a physical virginity, it was something else. And I wonder if you mind explaining that to the Wings listeners.
Yes, because this gets back to your original question that I never quite answered about virginity being the hymen that was intact. Virginity, I think, in the Greek time meant, yes, a woman who was celibate, who had not had sex with men, or who could energetically restore that state, and this is getting to your question. I have worked with a shaman from India. His name is Nandu Menon, and he has a couple of books published in this country. He does workshops with women on their reproductive functions and the energy streams that surround the uterus and so forth. He said to me that, and he told our whole seminar, that you can do what's called energetically restoring virginity to a womb by doing certain rituals and healings and banishments of energies that have come into the universe, into the uterus, or things that have happened. He does this in cases of abortion. He does this in cases of rape, where through his trance state, through his laying on of hands, whatever other kinds of methods he does, he clears the energy of a woman's uterus of this sort of previous entry of a male's energy into it, thereby being able to restore the intact aura, if you will, around the uterus, which amounts to restoring the virginity of the uterus and the vagina.
Well, I'm sorry to say that that's all the time that we have. My guest has been Dr. Marguerite Rigoglioso, a recently minted PhD from the California School of Integral Studies. Her dissertation is titled Bearing the Holy Ones, A Study of the Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece. Just one last question. Has doing this research changed you in any way, Marguerite?
Well, yes, it has. It's made me look at women's capacities, women's spiritual capacities, much differently. It's made me look at the Christian mystery of Mary's virgin birth much differently. It's really helped sort of lift the veil off my eyes of what may have been going on deep in our history and the role of women in the evolution of the planet. So there are many implications and ripples that will have in my life and hopefully in the lives of others.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, and thank you very much for having me.
Since this interview was recorded, Marguerite Rigoglioso has published 3 books, The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece, Virgin Mother Goddesses of Antiquity, and The Mystery Tradition of Miraculous Conception, Mary and the Lineage of Virgin Births. She has also created the Seven Sisters Mystery School for restoring the ancient way of the priestess. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found through the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
That was an interview borrowed from community radio show Wings. I'll play another Wings interview now. This one is about period pride and menstruation celebration and accommodation in India and around the world. You're listening to In the Motherhood on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thanks for listening.
Today on Wings, period pride in India.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Periods have been coming out of the closet politically around the world since at least 2004. That's the year a bill was introduced in Canada's Parliament to exempt menstrual hygiene products from federal tax. Countries that have now passed full or partial tax relief on such products include Kenya, Canada, India, Colombia, Australia, Germany, and Rwanda. More recently, some countries have considered mandating free menstrual hygiene products for some or all of their populace. A Canadian petition started in 2019 went to Parliament in 2020. Reactions were mixed, and the government did not act on it. Scotland, however, signed a Period Products Act into law in 2021. Now a government publication specifies that authorities have a duty to make sufficient menstrual hygiene products available free to anyone who needs them, regardless of sex or gender. In 2022, the Netherlands passed its own bill to make menstrual products free and easily accessible, but only to persons at or below the official national poverty level. The minister in charge estimated the cost per year would be around 2 million euros. She said inadequate access can be very restrictive, especially for young women. If they can no longer afford these products, that could determine whether they can still participate in school and other activities. She would like to expand the largesse to everyone, but the cost would be many times higher. Although India did remove its tax on menstrual products, they have not given in to a newer demand for paid period leave. A sympathetic male parliamentarian introduced a menstruation benefits bill in 2017, but withdrew it in 2022. Members from India's ruling party claimed the subject was a dirty matter to discuss in the Holy Assembly. Some women were also concerned that a requirement for menstrual leave benefits would hurt women's chances for employment. But now, students from India's colleges and universities have launched an online campaign and a petition demanding India's Labour and Employment Ministry create paid menstrual leave for working women in both the government and private sectors. They point to the 2014 report titled Spot On, published by the NGO DASRA, which found that nearly 23 million girls drop out of school annually in India due to lack of proper menstrual hygiene management facilities, which include availability of sanitary napkins and logical awareness of menstruation. The report also said there were 355 million menstruating women in India, nearly 30% of the country's population. The campaign for leave was launched by a woman law student in Odisha, a coastal state in eastern India, formerly known in the West as Orissa. Odisha is the only Indian state that holds a traditional celebration of menstruation. Kalpana Pradhan filed this report for Wings.
Odisha state is the only state in India where people celebrate menstruation and womanhood.
Rajo celebration is all about menstruating Mother Earth as well as menstruation of all women irrespective of age. 3 days of Rajo is to give complete rest to Earth as well as to all women.
The topic of menstruation is still huge taboo in India.
In period time, Women are not allowed to enter the kitchen room, not allowed to touch the jar of pickle. Even they are not allowed to sleep with their husbands.
And it cannot be denied that women are affected by periods.
Being a woman on the time of period, I am feeling so much pain and feeling irritating.
As a working woman, I can really understand the unbearable pain of a woman during the menstrual time.
And that is why period leaves are more important nowadays.
The Odisha woman Ranjita Priyadarshini has launched a campaign of paid period leave for women.
I believe that women have the right to period leave.
Menstruation is a taboo topic in the Indian society, but in the eastern Indian state of Odisha, people have been celebrating this every year in the form of a festival named Rajo Parbo with fun and gaiety. The festival relates the menstrual cycle of the goddess. According to mythology, on the 3 days of the festival, Mother Earth undergoes menstruation. On the 4th day, a ceremonial bath takes place with the beginning of the agricultural season. The eastern coastal state celebrates the regeneration of Mother Earth with a festival, Rajo Parbo. This is a 3 days festival specially for women and girls to come together to honor womanhood and acknowledge the gifts of Mother Earth across the state. The festival is natively pronounced as Rajo, a local term that means menstruating woman. The state observed Rajo Parbo festival to combat all the prejudices that surround the menstrual cycle and to celebrate girls' womanhood. During the 3 days, women are given a break from household chores. Sociology professor Dr. Rita Roy has an experience of 40 years in academics and consulting. She feels the Rajo Parbo celebration of womanhood is one of the main cultural festivals of Odisha. I asked her for more information.
Let's be clear that Rajo is not a religious festival but has high cultural significance for the people of this region. Rajo is the shorter version of Rajaswala, which means the woman who is menstruating. In this case, the woman symbolizes the body of the earth mother, who is the universal mother of all being. She is not only feminine but, like all other females, menstruates and reproduces. Let me assert that Rajo is the most important cultural festival of Odisha, which has sustained itself even in the wake of intense modernization, industrialization, because Odisha is largely a population of tribes and a state which is dominated by agricultural communities. Rajo celebration is all about menstruating Mother Earth as well as menstruation of all women irrespective of age. 3 days of Rajo is to give complete rest to Earth as well as to all women. It has regional variation in Odisha, tribal, non-tribal, and different reasons within the state. Typically, women will not do any household work. Men will do most of it, especially cutting vegetables and grinding spices. Girls will not work at all. Instead, they will swing in some temporary swing, sing song and praising the Earth Mother, declaring themselves as powerful regenerators of species, move around with their girlfriends, visit places with women. Depending on the occupation, tribes of different regions celebrate inside the forest, offering blood sacrifice to earth, usually a male animal, for better fertility and regeneration. Also, they call their ancestors for this purpose. Agricultural community offer milk, turmeric, and flour. These are the symbols of sustenance and health and beauty.
Professor, in India, menstruation is still a taboo and women still fight many stigmas, some of which keep them away from kitchens and places of worship. But this celebration doesn't shy away from the topic and mention of menstruation openly. Is it true?
Whatever be the ways of celebration, menstruation is the basis to applaud and it is open and clear. Though people use all symbolic languages of expressing menstruation, but it's openly understood that in order to be fertile, all have to menstruate like the Mother Earth. There are a lot of local ways of expressing fertility of Earth Mother as of the women. Hunger for food and sex is verbalized through different symbolic ways. Food during Roja has a special flavor which consists of rice pudding, cakes specially eaten only for this occasion. The most important part of it is that every household will exchange home-baked pita, which is the cake, to the neighbors and relatives. These will be carried by the girls. For the married women, it symbolizes huge prestige for the daughter-in-law to get a basket full of gifts specially brought by either the brother, father, or some male member from the village.
As you know, that recently paid period leave campaign has launched from Odisha and now it is getting response from throughout the country. What will be your views about it?
The present movement for paid leave for menstruation, according to me, may be a good initiative of feminist movement. But then taking away the earth's womanliness needs to be understood more clearly and not separating women from the mother.
Ranjita Priyadarshini, a law student of Odisha's Sambalpur town, has launched an online campaign demanding paid period leave for women employed in both government and private sectors during periods. Ranjita has also launched a signature campaign seeking support from women for the cause. Now, women and girls in throughout the country are supporting Ranjita's online campaign and seeking one day of menstrual leave in every month. As said, Tapaswini, a metal industry worker from Odisha state, Akanksha Maitro, a law student from Rajasthan state, and Pallavi, a factory worker in Odisha.
जब हमें पीरियड होता है बहुत पेट दर्द होता है, बदन में दर्द, बहुत तकलीफ के साथ काम करने का और भी तकलीफ होता है, इसलिए हमें एक दिन की छुट्टी मिलनी चाहिए.
The factory worker Tapushini was saying that during menstruation, she feels huge pain in her lower abdomen. Being a factory worker, she had to do her regular work, which is very painful for those days. If she will take leave, company will deduct her one day payment from her salary. Otherwise, she has to take medical leave. But in this case, she need to submit doctor's prescription, which is not possible in every month. That is the reason she support the paid period leave campaign.
Hello, it's Akanksha Mishra, and I am from Rajasthan. I really support Ranjita for the one-day period leave because actually during the period our body produces hormones that cause uterine contractions, aiding the shedding of the uterine lining. So when in our body the uterine contracts, that creates a lot of pain, and usually this pain is stomach pain, but sometimes this pain also manifests in the form of leg pain and backache. So working or doing job with the unbearable pain is really dejected. So don't you think that especially at this time women should take rest, which can help her for better health? So I really appreciate Ranjita for this campaign, and I really support her that every woman should get at least one day period leave without any problems.
Hi, I am Pallavi from India. I am supporting Ranjita's campaign paid period leave. Being a woman on the time of period first day, I am feeling so much pain and feeling irritating. So for making a healthy and happy work culture, if government approve it, then it will help all the working women of India.
On Wings, this is Kalpana Pradhan's report about the campaign for menstrual leave in India.
Ranjita Priyadarshini is only 28 years old. She has earlier worked in the heavy metal industry, and she felt the situation of women workers in the industries.
While some women cruise through their monthly cycle, others, particularly those with conditions like endometriosis or PMDD, that is premenstrual dysphoric disorder, they experience a range of effects, which researchers cite as some of the most common for women of reproductive age. Most women try to push through and go to work anyway. This is often because they feel reluctant to disclose period-related symptoms to their superiors for fear of being perceived as or incapable of doing their jobs.
Ranjita has urged to Indian Labour and Employment Minister to grant the provision to women employees, which constitute nearly a third of the total workforce in the country. She has also submitted a petition to State Labour and Employment Minister Sushant Singh in this regard. Ranjita was saying,
I am studying law and have been a previous employee in the heavy metal industry. Paid period leave have been a topic of debate in our country for a very long time. It is challenging, but definitely not a far-fetched reality. Recently, the Spanish government declared period leave policies for all. Currently, there are 12 companies in India which offer period leaves. Such initiatives not only create positive impact, but also sets an example for other companies to follow. It also shattered all taboo associated with period, and women are openly able to say that she is having period and might not be as productive at work as on other days.
though till today most part of the country, menstruation is still considered to be dirty and impure. Discrimination against menstruating women is widespread in India. Girls are taught to keep their period hidden from the outside world, and unfortunately, men and society fail to recognize the excruciating pain. It is very difficult to have an open discussion about it, as people seem to get extremely uncomfortable and prefer to discuss it behind closed doors. I think you realize and you can tell us more about it.
In India, the mentality of people and male-dominating culture create negative environment for a woman to discuss about period and menstrual related topics. In fact, when one woman shared uncertain period to her male friend, somehow the male person feel very uncomfortable to arrange or ask a pad to a pharmacy center. In some places in India, even in period time, women are not allowed to enter the kitchen room, not allowed to touch the jar of pickle. Even they are not allowed to sleep with their husbands.
Ranjita, you have faced a lot of problems in your working fields and has encountered in numerous cases where women workers suffered during their periods while at work due to lack of access to proper toilets, restrooms, and many more. Could you please tell me what kind of problem you faced?
I faced a lot of challenges during periods as my job was very demanding. I have terrible menstrual cramps and always used to take leave on my first day of period. Also, there were no proper restroom facilities and neither a clean toilet in the plant. When I started working as an HR welfare officer, I realized I was not alone. I encountered that women construction workers struggle more during their menses. Most of them would stain their clothes as well. Gradually, I interacted with lady workers, teachers, software engineers, weavers. Then I got to know the problem of periods is equal and deadly for all of them. Neither government bodies nor private bodies have any leave provisions during this period. This first-hand experience led me to started paid period leave campaign. Also, I reach out to the maximum number of people. Working ladies fearing the deduction of amount from their salary which do not avail leave during period and pushed with unbearable pain. Therefore, I demand in my petition at least one paid period leave in each month should be granted by our Honorable Union Labour Minister of India. We talk about work ethics and culture in national and international conferences, but nothing has been implemented on ground yet. Such a step will not only lead to a healthy environment, but also encourage women to work. I believe to create a positive working environment, which is important that women have the right to period leave. I have already been contacting labor unions across the country, asking them for their support to the campaign. I believe if there is a collective action taken by all the union members via physical signatures, we can approach the labor ministry.
As you said that you have knocked most part of the related government departments. So, how is the response?
I have received support from many national and international organizations like Global South Coalition on Dignified Menstruation Kathmandu, KGS Leo Club Kenya, Jinja Models Uganda, ICRW Washington, Period Magazine Netherlands, and many more. They have shared and signed my petition. Response has been great, and my petition has been featured by many local and national media and many more. There have been opposing views from most men, as they feel if women are given this leave, they would want something similar for all male workers too. However, I have received a lot of support from women workers across my network and from social media. It makes me feel very blessed to get support from a community of women employees. It is challenging to reach every woman till the last mile. It's still possible. We all know labor unions play an instrumental role in shaping policies. I have already been contacting labor unions across the country, asking them for their support to the campaign.
India has the Menstruation Benefits Bill 2017 that was tabled by a parliamentarian, Ninon Ering, in the parliament. And he also proposed the bill in the Arunachal Pradesh State Assembly too. The bill has proposed paid leave for working women when Mother Nature comes a knocking every month. The bill also looks to provide better rest facilities for women at their workplace during menstruation. But India's ruling party MLAs, members of Legislative Assembly, it's a dirty matter to discuss in the Holy Assembly, and the bill has been withdrawn in 2022. The concept of period leave is not new in India. Over the past few years, several private companies have already announced period leave for their female employees. In the neighboring state of Bihar, female government employees have been able to take 2 days of special leave every month for biological reasons for the past 30 years. Women activists are saying that it is not only disheartening, but disempowering when the people's representatives do not want to talk about menstrual health as a matter of state policy. Activists also feel that it is a high time for the companies to start this initiative to break the stigma around menstruation and make workspaces healthier for women. Kalpana Pradhan, Wings, Kolkata, India.
Menstrual leave already exists in Japan, Indonesia, and Zambia. As of December 2022, a bill for leave paid by the government instead of the employer was making its way through Spain's parliament. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, especially WERU-FM in Maine, also the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, U.S. chapter, and its president, Sheila Dallas Katzman, plus Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose recent events can be viewed on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. You can find our recent programs on our new website, wingsradio.org/WordPress. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer, Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
That was a radio documentary borrowed from Wings Community Radio Show. Thank you to Wings for sharing your content with us and with community radio shows across the world. You're listening to In the Motherhood on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host for today, Robin Fadden, and you can contact us and me at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca and on Facebook at CKUT-InTheMotherhood. Thanks for listening.
This is Brother Andrew from Starship Tricky Woo. A little song for you. CKUT, take a bite out of me. I see you K-U-T. I take a bite out of me. When I listen to my radio, I listen to the rock and roll sounds of a CKUT. A CKUT, I take a bite out of me. A CKUT, I take a bite out of me.
You're listening to Amandla Radio, your weekly broadcast with news and analysis from the continent of Africa.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial www.ckut.ca on the internet. Beginning in December 2010, unprecedented mass demonstrations against poverty, corruption, and political repression broke out in several Arab countries, challenging the authority of some of the most entrenched regime in the Middle East and North Africa. Such was the case in Egypt, where in 2011 a popular uprising forced one of the region's longest-serving and most influential leaders, President Hosni Mubarak, from power. The first demonstrations occurred in Tunisia in December 2010, triggered by the self-immolation of a young man, frustrated by Tunisia's high employment rate and rampant police corruption. Rallies calling for President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali to step down spread throughout the country, with the police often resorting to violence to control the crowds. As clashes between police and protesters escalated, Ben Ali announced a series of economic and political reforms in an unsuccessful attempt to end the unrest. Demonstrations continued, forcing Ben Ali to flee the country. The apparent success of the popular uprising in Tunisia, by then dubbed the Jasmine Revolution, inspired similar movements in other countries,